Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
53106 is our text number. That'll cost you 30 cents. You can send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can just shout out the window. One of our staff will rush down to your house and hear what your message is and relay it back to us. We were talking about zombies and whether it says something about our culture in general. God, I love zombies. If I'm reincarnated, everyone to come back as a zombie. That would be the coolest thing ever, says Mikey. Well, that's not reincarnation. Zombies are reanimated. They're not even resurrected. They're just kind of basically brainless things going around wanting to eat your delicious brains. Liam says, sure, they've even adapted Pride and Prejudice into a zombie novel. They are taking over. It's called Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Snazzy title. I know, it's a good one. It's just, we'll just put zombies in there. Just left a large shopping centre, says John. It was full of zombies munching junk food and staring into the middle distance. I didn't hit any with a baseball, though. Jarrah says The Walking Dead is part of a policy introduced by a W the Destroyer to blood America after the military claimed the US had become too soft. That's an interesting theory. Waking up in a zombie attack is my ultimate nightmare. Well, it wouldn't be a nightmare if you woke up in the middle of it, clearly. Isn't the point of The Walking Dead in particular not really the zombies, but the Walking Dead, i.e. the other humans who will inevitably become zombies, and how people deal with this inevitability? Some become nihilists and others try to retain their humanity while civilization as we know it has stopped, says Michael. That's a very very intelligent and interesting interpretation of all that. And while I was reading that out, Tomás Clancy was nodding furiously. Because no, apart from being a wide expert, are you a zombie fan, Tomás?
I'm a huge zombie fan. I think we're going to look back at, like, on zombies like they look back on the 1950s sort of invasion movies. It's the same thing. It's absolutely about where we are now. And I think his analysis is perfect.
This is the golden age of zombies, is
this
what you're saying.
This is the golden age of zombies.
Yes. Esther McCarthy's here too.
I love zombie movies. I just love them. But there's a really, that text from Michael was interesting about the kind of post-zombie analysis, because we've got a movie coming out dealing with that very subject this year called The Third Wave. It's an Irish film, first time writer-director, and the script impressed Ellen Page so much, the Juno actress that she signed up, over and made it. And it's set like several years after a zombie apocalypse, when people have been actually cured, and it's about whether society will accept them back in or not, given that they were trying to eat their brains.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't it interesting?
That's an interesting take on that. Because you'd think we might be reaching peak zombie, and that there's only so many ways you can...
Yeah.
You can make up stories about zombies.
Yeah, well, really. They found a cure is good news.
Well, speaking of running out of story ideas but still doing it at the same time, I see the Transformers have another movie.
Yeah. Oh, God, Sean. if anyone tells me I have a great job this weekend, I might actually box them in the head, because it's one of these I see them so you don't have to films. Like, it's so bad. It's 2.5 hours of bad. It's incoherent. I haven't a clue. Don't ask me to sum the plot for you, because I really didn't understand.
All right, I'm looking forward to that then, when you just explain the plot.
Yeah, actually, Little White Lies, which is kind of the new hip new movie reviewer publication on the block, did a review 2 days ago based entirely on questions. They just laughed at it. Like, and they managed to sustain it and even like tell us a little bit about it, but it was like questions like, you know, why has Mark Wahlberg got a terrible haircut? Is China to blame? Does Michael Bay hate cinema? So it was a brilliant piece of writing, I have to say. And
yeah, I like the headline in the Irish Times. They described it as 2.5 hours of effluent.
lest people think it's just us snooty critics not liking a movie for being a crowd pleaser or entertaining. I would just say tread carefully on this one, even if you're a Transformers fan, because like some of the earlier films had their charms and they did appeal to kids. And Optimus Prime is a great character, of course missing here due to the circumstances of the last film, but this one really is.
You lost
like,
me there.
It's really dead.
He joined a commune. he got a job in a sitcom. Optimus Prime in more wacky situations. Also, Hampstead.
Hampstead is lovely.
Is it?
Yeah.
Are you sure? Really, is it now just because you love Diane Keaton?
Partly, yeah.
Parking that aside, is it?
Yeah, Diane Keaton's in it.
Okay, I see.
No, right. I would say it's very light. It's a kind of a romantic drama based very loosely on a really interesting real life story, actually, which we'll go into a bit later. But it's It's made by a guy called Joel Hopkins, who made a film called Last Chance Harvey with Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson, I think, a few years ago. And you know, it's a light movie, but the cast make for very amiable company, I suppose. What I would say about
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with it being a light movie. I suppose it's you know, is it funny enough? Is it charming enough? Is it believable?
Lots of charm. Yeah. Lots of charm here. Yeah.
So, Tomas, hipster champagne, is that not a contradiction in terms?
Not even in the slightest.
I see.
Hipster champagne is where it all began. In the 18th and 19th century, it was full of people who were on the make, who were very fashionable and were selling this thing to, you know, the fashionable nobility of France. And kind of we've lost it as many sort of these champagnes become more august and less sort of playful. Mm. And what this gentleman, this is Champagne Brimoncourt, which basically was invented in 2008 by a man, Alexander Corneau, who was in the Navy, an adventurer, a tax lawyer, an art seller, an art dealer for Sotheby's, and you know, just a fantastically interesting fellow with a beautiful beard. And then he came back. A friend of his got into trouble. His business was nearly going bankrupt back in Champagne, and he, with his naval, military, artistic, and tax skills,
yes,
thought this is the job for me. So he returned to Champagne.
Is it relatively? I mean, obviously, it has to be made in Champagne. But is it relatively rare for a new champagne to come out?
Hugely rare, because the barriers to entry are that you have to buy the grapes that other people are already using for Dom Perignon, Cristal, Roederer, Bollinger. You know, these are not names to be trifled with, and they're luxury goods, so you have to get back into this. So the way you do this is you do exactly what this man did, was you carefully tickle trout. You build up small relationships with people, and of course, he'd come back to help rescue this champagne printing business. They printed the labels for champagne bottles.
Huh.
And so he then got to meet lots of people, chat with them, talk with them, do business with them. And over a couple of years, he sort of got himself into a position where he then, when he said, "You wouldn't have a few hours spare grapes there by any chance," he eventually said, "Yes, we do." And he's managed to do that. So he's created this fantastically interesting sort of brand called Champagne Brimoncourt, which for the box and bottle is a giraffe wearing a military uniform.
Yes.
Giraffes, the only animals that don't drink alone. Hence,
I did not know that. Okay, right. And why is the giraffe wearing a military uniform?
His military background, and his father was in the army. And
okay, all right.
Yeah. And
why not?
And no. See, champagne is we think of it as being full of, you know, great sparkling wine, but of course it's tank country, and has been the front line for wars for about 600. Well, for about 2,000 years now. But you know, World War II, tanks coming over the Marne. World War I, the front line along the Ardennes. It's full of military bases. The Maginot Line is just down the road, so they're all in the army.
So
when you're actually there, it's kind of like it's quite a military sort of background, and almost everybody's either got a parent or an uncle or an aunt who's they're either in the army or they're making champagne.
I'm glad you explained that, because if I were to look just at the box, I would thought,
yeah,
we dropped acid and decided to design a champagne label.
Well, you know, let's not rule it out. He says,
he's been around this fella. And also, is it a Shiraz we're drinking today?
Yes, we're drinking a brilliantly named Shiraz, which is called Clancy's.
Of course it is.
It has such an attractive name. I was just drawn to it immediately. It's Peter Lehman is the producer, and it's called Clancy's, not after moi. I have no relationship with anybody involved in it. Not one single cent or even a wink is of happiness.
But the label kind of looks like it might be a whiskey or something rather than a...
Doesn't it? It has that kind of old 18th century kind of charm. And what it is that this fella, Clancy, the Clancy referred to, was a drover in Australia. And there was a fellow who wrote a poem about this fellow, Clancy. This poem became hugely famous. It's called Clancy of the Overflow. I know. Clancy of the Overflow.
Oh, here comes Clancy of the Overflow.
He really pours a bad glass of wine. So Clancy of the Overflow. And not only that, but if you look at the $10 Australian note, you will find the poem wherein the character Clancy is contained in micro writing on it. And the author, Andrew Banjo, what the heck is his name? Andrew Banjo Patterson. Patterson is on the front of the, is on the, he's the author, he's the poet. And so this Clancy is very famous down there.
Okay.
It's associated with wildness and ease of life and the outback.
Right. Know? Okay. So right. Okay. As soon as movies and booze stars, we usually get the usual spate of I found a bottle of wine in the boot of my car. Am I a millionaire now? Mairead in Galway says, I found this bottle of wine in my parents' house when clearing it out for a demolition. It was hidden away and probably forgotten about. It's a Bouchard, a Pear and Fils Pernand Verglacius. Côte d'Or 1984, she wants to know. So has Mairead hit the jackpot there?
She hasn't hit the total jackpot, but that's a very good wine. Bouchard Pear et Fils is a superb négociant house in Beaune. The Verglacius is basically a nice set of hills which are behind Courton, so at the back of Courton. So Courton, very famous vineyard, at the front overlooking the little medieval city of Beaune. This just a bit round the corner. Mm-hmm. Sort of 6W.
This is West Hampstead then. Otherwise known as Kilburn.
So it's West Hampstead, and people, I have friends who used to get off at West Hampstead and then walk the six and a half kilometres to Kilburn. So that's when you get off. It's basically the Kilburn to West.
You're not
Hampstead.
Really selling that, really. No. Anthony wants to know, I used to be able to buy a wine called Colonial Estate from the Barossa. Is it still being imported? There was one called Emigre and another one called Exile.
He is bringing a tear to my eye. Those were some of my favourite wines. They're made by a very fine French winemaker in Saint-Emilion, and who makes many great Saint-Emilion wines. But he then went and did an he went down to Australia, and these are Australian wines. And he opened up a thing called Colonial. He's British. Well, he's actually Kenyan. He was born in Kenya and then moved to Saint-Emilion. So this was him establishing another colonial office in Australia. You can't get them anymore because he stopped making them. Oh. He did it as an experiment for 3 or 4 years. But what he has done is he's gone to Napa Valley, and he now makes, he's got Heaven's Gate, he's got a Jimi Hendrix wine, a Pink Floyd wine, and a Bob Dylan wine, and he's making them in Napa Valley. They don't come to Ireland. They're £500 a bottle.
Crikey. Does he license those names? Does Dylan own a bit of the vineyard, or they've taken some there?
No, he doesn't, although Bob Dylan does own a bit of a vineyard, as do a lot of people. So Sting has his own vineyard, and all the rest of these guys, they all have something there. But so he's gone ahead and done this. He's got Axis is Bold, but he picks names that that people will recognise, but they're not too obvious. And he's making wine in Napa, so
that's,
you could think about
that's
those.
Interesting. Amy says, my French grandfather passed away. He had a large wine collection and left me two bottles of Domaine de la Romanée Conti red wine in his will. They're Burgundy wines, just wondering how much they're worth. Oh, hello.
Well, hello.
Book that holiday, Amy.
Okay, those are the best wines of the world, right? So we often have
people
we have people ringing in with a lot of interesting things, and the previous wine is a nice wine, but you'd be looking at sort of maybe 50 or 60 euros.
Okay, so we're not talking Kilburn here.
Oh my goodness. No. Domaine Romanée Conti is the absolute tenderloin. It's the bullseye of great Burgundy. The Prince of Conti in the 18th century owned these lands, and he had one vineyard called La Romanée. And so Domaine La Romanée Conti, those are maybe 2,000 to 3,000 euros a bottle. If there's any age on them at all, if they're authentic, you can sell these at auction bottle by bottle.
Yeah.
As we're always saying every week, you can't, there's no value in finding a single bottle, in a case of these things, except when you get to this kind of peak level here. That is a fantastic grandfather. All grandfathers are great, but that's a
particularly
very
good one.
A particularly good one. Well chosen.
She must have been his favourite.
I'm beginning to suspect so. Now,
all he left me was three bottles of Kilburn. You got.
No, she did this. You have an absolutely. Those are two unbelievable, potentially unbelievably good wines. There should be a black and white label. They should be, you should have some nice large printing on them. They were looking for the capsule not to be too badly corroded, and you want the thing to be high on the hip. So the hip of the bottle is the bit where it curves, where the neck is. You want it to be just up towards, if you see that up towards the neck of that, you're dealing with something that could be worth thousands.
So wow.
I would say go now, go to any of the larger sort of older sort of wine shops that would do this. Don't see where they are, but Green Acres is down in Wexford, Mitchell's and Sons up in Dublin, those kind of places. They'll put you straight onto where to go next.
Right. Okay. Let's move on to our first wine. We are going to drink fabulous Clancy's.
This is a Cabernet Merlot Shiraz blend, and it is named, as I said, for this man called Clancy of the Overflow. And for Australians, Clancy of the Overflow occupies the same kind of position that we have for the Quiet Man. It references back to a time that probably never existed, where the countryside was full of happy-go-lucky, jolly people, and even the sort of fights between sort of the IRA and the local big house were all done in a roolia-boolia kind of happy kind of way. It's just that life probably definitely never existed, but that's what we all dream. Maybe living in the sort of 20s to 30s was like. And that for them was evoked in the 1880s by this man called Andrew Barton Patterson. And he was a poet who wrote all these things about the wild goings on in the outback in this period, just when the first generation of Australians were now becoming citified folk. And he wrote them for that. So this idea of Clancy of the Overflow, he wrote a letter, and you'll see it on the front of this bottle if you just about see it.
Oh,
on
yes,
the label,
you can. Yeah.
There's a little piece of writing there, and that's written. It was written in a response to this man called Andrew Patterson, who was a solicitor. He was bored, mindless, and he wrote doing his job every day. But he wrote a letter to a friend that he'd met, this fellow Clancy, and he knew he was at an outback station called the Overflow, so he just addressed it to Clancy of the Overflow, and what came back was a small piece of note which was clearly written with somebody's finger dipped into ink, which said, "Clancy's gone droving. God knows where he is. We don't know where he is. He'll be back in a couple of months." And this whole idea of, being on horseback, driving sort of cattle and sheep, it kind of touched the imagination of Australians at that time. And they pined for going back to the outback and the freedom of those days, rather like the cowboy films in the 30s and 40s.
Absolutely, yeah.
Same event. So when Peter Lehman was a great winemaker in the 1960s and 70s in Australia. Up until the 60s, all Australian wine, the majority of it, was essentially fortified wine. They imported regular wine, but what they did was they turned everything into fortified wine, like port.
Ugh.
And that was their big thing, and they were very good at it. He was one of the first people to, along with the Penfolds group, to go to Europe, see dry wine, see how it was made, come back, and then try and reverse engineer it. And he was a bit of a hero. He opened up the Barossa to dry winemaking. His wines are now very expensive. And so what he died, unfortunately. So what he was looking for, he produced a range of wines that were cheaper. And so to trigger into this, what we've got is Clancy of the Overflow. So you've got, it's cowboy wine. It's easy drinking, easy available, smooth, soft, delicious wine. It's not there to be kept or to be revered. It's there to be drunk happily.
And
now,
it's a blend. Calling it just a Shiraz.
It's a Shiraz Cabernet Sauvignon Merlot blend. Now, the even better part here is that it's channeling a dark past in the 19th century, which is that this is probably the original way that Bordeaux was, because Bordeaux wines were made up of Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon, but oftentimes they were rather weak. And so what they did was they snuck over to the Rhone and they bought Syrah, Shiraz, and they brought it back in hay trucks and barrel loads and all the rest of it, and they blended it in with their thing. They boosted it, and it was called a doctor. It was a little curative, a palliative. So they doctor, and they're so doctoring wine and doctoring things comes this, but it was really meant not to doctor, it was actually to cure it. So it built it up from this. And so what he's done is he's got himself here an 18th century Bordeaux as well. So every part of this, the drovers, the cowboys, and even the wine itself has has that kind of 19th century sort of feel to it. And I think it's a really smashing wine. It's very widely available. It's around about €13 or so.
Okay, yeah, great.
You'd find it in Morton's and the drink store in Donoghue and Londis and, you know, all of those kind of sort of good shops, and it's a very, very fine thing. Peter Lehman's Clancy Shiraz from the Barossa Valley.
Banjo Patterson wrote the words to Waltzing Matilda. Helsey's remembered on Aussie Money Wines, etc.
Yeah.
Well, says a texter.
And Clancy the Overflow.
Yeah. Brent says, your wine expert recommended 3 weeks ago, I don't know if it was you, Tomas, an Argentinian Malbec called Love. I've looked everywhere in Ireland to no avail. Should I give up or stop listening to him?
You shouldn't stop listening to me because it wasn't me.
Okay. There you go. Wines can get mentioned on this programme and they tend to sell out afterwards. That could be, you know, that could be a thing. When Tomás mentions that Clancy's wine, go and get it now. We'll wait until the show's over, then get it. Right, Esther, what movie would you like to talk about
first? I suppose we better do Transformers.
Let's do Transformers after this.
All they want is a home, and you know it. You push them, and they push right back. Me and my crew are rolling out of here. Let's go. They're not gonna touch us.
All right, Star One abort. Negative Decepticon activity.
TRS, stand fast. Drop your guns.
You sure you don't want to shoot? I'm a big old target. Wusses.
Whose side are you on? They're all bad.
No, they're not.
There you go, $260 million to make. That was Transformers the last night. Eamon says, the only thing I'm looking forward to about this movie is Anthony Hopkins, especially after Westworld. Is it even worth it for him?
No.
Okay. Now for
$260 million, and not a cent of it spent on the script.
Yes. No, yes. Now for 10 points, try and explain the plot of this movie.
It's actually a talking point among reviewers. I know I get teased sometimes on the technical sci-fi movies in particular of not being quite with the program on in terms of plotting, but this has become a talking point for critics about how incoherent it all is. Mm-hmm. Really, like, there's just batty stuff happens. You almost wonder were they trying to have a laugh and it just didn't quite work out. And I have a theory now at this stage. That Chris Miller and Phil Lord were parted ways with the new the Star Wars spin-off, the Han Solo project, this week. Apparently, it was a mad story because it's they've been filming since February and they parted ways this week. So there's something obviously gone down there.
Oh, seriously,
but apparently the story was that they were trying to bring a bit of kind of manic humor, which they're known for, into Star Wars, and that they were Lucasfilm were having none of it. So I have a theory now that Michael Bay should just walk away for the sake of humanity from the Transformers series and let somebody like these guys take over and actually have a bit of fun with it, because it's just like, I know some people would take this as a recommendation. It's just robots baiting the heads off each other for 2.5 hours.
That's as good a summary of the plot as one could hope for,
it's
really.
It's as good one as you're going to get.
Yeah.
And it's like, and so it seems like, every minute of the running time as well, I have to say.
Is Marky Mark desperate for work that he's still doing this crap?
Yeah, he said this is his last one. I think he did say he wants his life back in an interview. Yeah. So he has said, I don't know, I find he always makes... I wonder, is it one for him, one for the studio? Is that his kind of attitude? Because he often makes really good movies in between this kind of nonsense, you know? But he's back here anyway as Cage Jaeger, and he's trying to protect... So in the last film, what happened was the Autobots were the goodies and the Decepticons were the baddies, basically.
Aren't they always the goodies and the baddies?
Yeah. But in the last film, what happened was they all turned on humanity and tried to, like Cybertron, tried to turn entire planet Earth into robot slaves. So the humans fought back.
Ah.
And the remaining Autobots are under the protection and hiding from Mark Wahlberg's character, who's kind of... you know, trying to repair them, running ostensibly running a scrap metal car premises, but really the scrap turns into Autobots, which is quite cool, actually.
Okay.
But he is like, it just gets him. There's mad stuff going on. Okay, there's a whole military group from led by Josh Duhamel. They've been tasked with tracking down all of the remaining Autobots and annihilating them, basically. So he's hiding from them. And then he joins forces with this university professor. So Michael Bay's Totti du jour this time, a character played called Vivian Wembley. And she is kind of...
but she's in a, you know, she's in a university. So yeah. She's empowering women while looking at her boobs. Yeah.
She has lovely boobs, in fairness.
I'm sure she has.
You do get to see them often enough. Yeah. Her cleavage now, for instance, not her, all of her boobs. And she's this character who's kind of this genius historian type character. And she joins forces with them to try and track down the origins and where they all are and stuff. And then...
I've got to ask, why is a history professor uniquely qualified to look at the history of robots from outer space?
Because she looks like a more intelligent Megan Fox.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's just about anybody you described there.
And then, like, up pops Anthony Hopkins in this character, and he's like... He's this, so they put forward the theory, and I mean, it has been done in other films really effectively. So, and in fairness, historically, the Transformers characters have kind of been in the past as well, you know. So even though the first film said they crashed to Earth at this time, we're now expected to think that they were involved in a war with Nazi Germany, and that they were also...
Is this the same ones or different ones?
Same ones, yeah.
Okay.
And that they were also involved in the story of King Arthur, so that there's a robot war in the round the
So does this mean there's going to be like 17,000 sequels explaining all this nonsense?
I don't know what's going on here. The story is batty. The storytelling is really incoherent. Like, and you know, Anthony Hopkins is expected to say lines of dialogue that no self-respecting actor would have of work behind him such
now, Hopkins is a good way of making absolute nonsense sound like it's clever.
And I think as well he is winking at the camera here. Yeah. You know, so that's all going on. But then there is another plot thread involving a teenage girl called Isabella, who's like, I assume to draw in the younger audiences and who has a special connection with Transformers. But that's just kind of raised and dropped throughout the course of the film as well, and never really pulled together in any meaningful way. So when you don't know what's going on, you just become alienated from the film, you know.
Yes.
You just, and that's the end of it. Like, and I mean, visually it looks great. The special effects are great. I would say if you could watch it with the volume turned down and stop trying to figure out what's going on, that you might actually enjoy it for the spectacle it is. But it really is just a big stupid, and not in a good way. I love me dumb blockbusters, but not in a good way. A big stupid kind of film that just lurches from one scene to the next.
That's all we need to say about it.
Yeah.
Michael says, that's a shame about the Transformers film. I was hoping that Wahlberg would be able to learn how to act by copying the CGI robots. There's no hope for him. My mum got work as an extra in Transformers. They came here and filmed for one day in the long room in Long Room Library in Trinity. Don't know if there's a shot of her in it. I don't think I could bear having to sit through it to catch a tiny glimpse of her.
Now, that's really interesting.
That's very interesting,
Did spot a beautiful looking library, but set in the UK. A lot of the scenes in the film were set in the UK, and I did spot a beautiful library
that
scene.
Must be, and that is a beautiful
place. That looks like Long Room. Yeah. I didn't know they had shot here. Yeah.
I think Marky Mark would like to be known by his serious acting name of Mark Wahlberg. Marky Mark got thrown out of his tighty whitey's undies back in the 90s. I was just indicating to listeners that he's had a varied career, let's say. I watched an hour of Shia LaBeouf staging his silent protest against Trump on a webcam. It was still better than the Transformers franchise. And Amy has been on to us again. That's the woman who got the bottle of wine from her grandfather. She said, it's got a black and white label. The year is 1966. Is that good?
Unbelievable. Okay. Yeah, all right, yeah. I think pay dirt, you know.
Pay dirt there. Okay, Amy, we're going to break open the champagne in your honour after this commercial break.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big cheque for the delivery guy? GasNetworks.ie/movetogas.